It's all possible. If you are not a current member, you can take care of that right now and avoid the rush. Just go right now to KBOO.FM and click on donate. That rush is happening. Spring drive next week. We hope that you're a member already, but just go ahead, join us and support Community Radio, KBOO.
Thanks. We'll see you next week. Or hear you.
Oh.
Happy about the current political regime? Want to do something about it? Something social justice related? But how do you find out about these things? Portland Resistance Calendar lets you know about a lot of these happening in the Portland area for the next week. It's a weekly podcast. It's a blog. It's a calendar. It's a floor cleaner. It's updated on Fridays. Learn more at kboo.fm/resist.
KBOO is a proud media sponsor of the Beaverton Symphony Orchestra's last concert of the season. The performances take place on May 19th and 21st at the VBC Grand Auditorium in Beaverton. They will perform Robert Schumann's first symphony, entitled Spring, as well as Emily Doolittle's composition Green Blue. Doolittle is the latest artist in the Beaverton Symphony Orchestra's Northwest Composers Project. Also, the Young Artist Concerto Competition winners will appear and showcase the young musicians in Washington County. Again, the performances will be on May 19th and 21st at the VBC Grand Auditorium, located at 330 Southwest Murray Boulevard in Beaverton. Detailed information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This is KBOO Portland. It's just after 9 o'clock a.m., coming up on Pacific Underground, discussing the pros and cons of having an Asian and Pacific Islander Heritage Month, and featuring the Mazzy Show. That's right. We'll have clips, and I believe some of the folks involved will be joining us live in the studio. So make sure you stay tuned. That's coming up now.
Good morning. You are listening to Pacific Underground on KBOO Portland. We're the show that, we dissect the issues for the Asian and Pacific Islander American community here in Portland, Oregon. And we have a live show today for AAPI Heritage Month. Woohoo! Or boo.
Well, that's what we're going to unpack today.
We're going to unpack that today. So I'm one of your hosts for today, Jenny Okuyama. Let's go around the table. Who's here with us?
I'm Tabitha Teo.
I'm Kanan Schlesinger.
And I'm Jake Vermoss.
Welcome, Jake, by the way. Jake's first time here on Pacific Underground, so welcome and thanks for joining us today.
He's one of our guests today.
One of our guests, appreciate it. So if you listened 1 year ago, so go back in your memories and say, okay, what did they do a year ago? Okay, now we all remember.
Can you believe this was a year ago?
Yeah, so a year ago we did an Asian American Pacific Islander Heritage Month show because, it comes around once a year. And this year we decided to do another show, but this year it's titled the awkward API Heritage Month show, which is a reference to last year where we discovered our episode came out really awkward, to be honest, because we when we went to celebrate this month, we realized, wow, all of us kind of had different opinions and experiences with AAPI Heritage Month, where one of our members was super on board with it. I was really kind of anti. Tabitha was...
I was meh.
Kanan, yeah, you were
very middle of the road.
Agnostic, but inconvenienced by it, maybe.
So, you know, so that way this year we decided, like, let's unpack this a little bit more. Let's talk a little bit about, like, all our different feels about it. Instead of just, like, talking about the history of the month, let's kind of dive into what is AAPI Heritage Month for API people.
But we'll also talk about the history.
We'll talk about the history of it.
Did all the research I do not matter?
To give us some context about why we have all these different feels about it. Tabitha, can you give us a little history about it?
So, I love history. And so I did a little research into the history of the month. There is a website for if people would like to research this themselves. It is AsianPacificHeritage.gov, all one word. And it was first proposed in 1977 by Representative Frank Horton from New York, and to proclaim the first 10 days in May as Asian Pacific American Heritage Month. And May was chosen because it has significance to American heritage, Asian American history, because it was to celebrate the first Japanese immigrants coming over in May 5th in 1843, as well as the completion of the transcontinental U.S. Railroad on May 10th, and a majority of the workers that worked on that railroad were Chinese immigrants. So that's why May is designated as the month. And it was also proposed by Senator Daniel Inouye, of Hawaii. Who is, I read his Wikipedia article. He was a really cool guy.
He was. He did a lot. He did a lot for the API community.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
it was an amazing
person. Yeah. And, I mean, in 1977, the proposal failed, but in 1978, Frank Horton proposed the president should designate the first week in May. And that passed, and for the next decade, they kept proposing having proclamations that the president should declare this. And then in 1990, it was expanded from a week to a month. And in 92, there was a law that designated May as Asian Pacific American Heritage Month.
Well, thank you for the history, Tabitha. We appreciate that. So, you know, it does extend back this idea, you know, it extends back the idea of May all the way back to, you know, the 1800s when, I forget the Japanese guys that came over. He came over on this boat, and it's a big, long, like, story. And then the railroad part, that's really interesting that it's, like, linked with that. It's like, oh, man, that's all sorts of uncomfortable but real feelings about Americanness.
But the one thing that I like about, is this really Pacific Islander? Because it's all related to history of, like, Japanese and Chinese Americans in America. But it doesn't celebrate any milestones in, like, Pacific Islander history.
Right. I'm glad you're pointing out, like, one of the things that's kind of, like, problematic about this month is so much, you know, people often focus, like, we call it AAPI, and even if AAPI people are the ones who are promoting this month and putting, you know, a lot of the information out there, a lot of the non-AAPI people really focus on East Asians when they think about, like, Asian heritage and all that sort of stuff. Well, you know,
that's
done
a good
enough
point.
Talking here. Jake, why don't you give us some perspective about, like, how do you feel about AAPI month?
I agree that you know, Southeast Asians and Pacific Islanders are definitely underrepresented in sort of the general public definition of what API is. And I think that's something that a lot of people are actively working to dispel. You know, I mean, you have a lot of, especially recently with all the hate crimes towards Muslim Americans and Indian Americans, that, like, you know, South Asia is still considered Asia also. There's a history of colonialism there that's different than the history in Southeast Asia and, you know, East Asia. But the conversation is always dominated by East Asian just by virtue of them being there first. You know, the Chinese railroad workers, mm-hmm. the Japanese farmers, and you know, it wasn't till, like, the 1900s that you would have, after the colonization of the Philippines, you would have Filipino laborers coming over. And I think, yeah, I mean, we could talk all we want about the limitations of the definition. I mean, it's very arbitrary, but...
the definition of API?
Yeah.
MPI, what does all that
right.
mean? Yeah.
It's,
yeah, we could talk
the,
for days about
you know,
it.
It. You know, but in the end, all definitions are really approximations and kind of arbitrary in the end. So it's just something that, like, people lump themselves together from being othered, you know, consistently in the history of the Vietnam War, you know, and after internment, there was never really any consciousness that there was any similarities between these countries at all, other than they were, like, not white. Mm. So, yeah. So I read that in the 1950s, the whole definition of Asian American, you know, like being limited to just Asia and not the Pacific Islanders.
I also interesting you bring that up because I also did some history about the etymology and history of the word like Asian American, how it became like this encompassing term for people that live or have roots in a continent. And so the word Asia has been around since the time of the Greeks. And it was meant to refer to people east of the Aegean Sea. And then it was expanded to include the Anatolian Peninsula, where modern-day Turkey is. And it stretched further east. And there was a map of what the Greeks considered Asia. It's a huge geographical area. So it's like stretches all the way from Siberia all the way to the Indian subcontinent and all the way from like the Mediterranean to Japan. So huge area. And I found the term Asian American was coined by Yuji Ichioka, who was an adjunct professor at UCLA. And he used it as to create a new self-defining political lexicon and unify different Asian ethnic groups. And this was also to coincide with the founding of the Asian American Political Alliance in 1968. And this was an activist, Asian American activist movement organization that was around, that was founded around like fighting oppression, the Vietnam War. It was also related to the Black Power and the Black Panther movement. And I thought that was very interesting. And before Mr. Ichioka coined this term, the term that Asians were often called Orientals, which is an outdated...
Or Celestials.
Oh, dude. Ooh, by the way, you guys, real quick, I was called an Oriental the other day when I went to a gardening store.
Oh,
I
damn.
Asked for a gardening hoe, and the guy told me, like, oh, maybe you want one of the big gardening hoes like all the Orientals use. And he just kind of smiled at me really big. I was just like...
Wow.
Oh, wow, dude.
People still use that word?
Okay, here's the thing. This is when we, like, let it pass, you know, a little, because it's not worth the argument, because the dude looked like he was, like, 80. But I was like, wow... Y'all just told me about Oriental garden hose. And I know exactly what he's talking about because, like, my family, like, has gardeners in it. So I know exactly what he's talking about. But he's like, yeah, all the Orientals use them. It's just like, oh, a Portland moment. And, you know, yeah, sorry. That was a total side vibe. When you said that, I was just like, oh, my God, I forgot to tell you guys about my Oriental moment the other day. So there you go.
Wow.
So it's still very much in use and very much, like, causes that feeling of, like, called me an Oriental.
That is not the preferred nomenclature.
Well, can we talk about real quick about you're talking about the definition of like Asian American. If you remember, we had that episode where we featured Nobuko from the band Yellow Pearl from the 1970s, and they were really known, like their album is now in the Smithsonian because it's known as being the first, I think, like music album that uses the term Asian American. And when we think about that, that's only from like 1970s, something like 72. And so how actually recent this concept of Asian American really is.
Mm-hmm. And I think you've told me this, Jenna, but before this all-encompassing term was used, like communities would identify themselves as like Chinese American, Japanese American, Filipino American. And then there was this term Asian American that we could all fall under this
great umbrella.
This great umbrella pan-Asianism.
Oh, it's so much fun. Kanan, do you got any sort of opinions about AAPI Month?
Well, I think one thing that's often overlooked is the role that Central and South Asians had in creating AAPI Month. I'm just kidding. They had no role because they're completely excluded from that month, because when we think about the term Asian American, I think we only think about East Asian. And I think Asian in a lot of white America's eyes equates to East Asian. And I think there is a great deal of erasure that happens. And I don't think this is an easily mitigated problem that we deal with when we try to make an inclusive month for all people on the Asian continent or of descent or of Asian descent, whatever that even means, because I don't think there even is like a consistent meaning. One thing that recently I learned, speaking about the term Oriental, I think that it's also, I think, from Greek times, like ancient Roman or Greek times, and it kind of refers to like the places kind of so far east where Alexander the Great like couldn't really quite conquer fully or like hold onto for too long. And so it's like the Indian subcontinent, it's Central Asia, it's Southeast Asia, it's what we now know as East Asia, and like Mongolia, China, Japan, those were all like kind of like myths to what we now know as the Western world, mm-hmm. which is kind of mind-blowing that there was like the breadbasket, or this is what white nationalists say and like white people say in general, but like the breadbasket of like Western civilization, like the Romans and the Greeks were just like doing their thing. And there were also like huge empires rising and falling in East Asia as well. So I don't know, that's kind of a tangent, but I just think there's a lot of erasure that happens. And
to be fair, that's a conversation that definitely people are starting to have more, and that needs to be had. I don't know if you guys remember that time there was a New York Times editor, Chinese American guy, who got racially abused on the streets of like Queens or something like that. He made this video recently, like, I am Asian America, whatever. And if you notice though, like out of the 50 people, they were like almost all East Asian, light skinned East Asians. And they got a lot of clap back for that, and rightly so, because I mean, it's an imperfect definition, but it's still something that loosely applies, and it's better to see yourself sort of like represented somewhat like imperfectly than not represented at all.
Yeah. I'll say that, you know, amongst our Pacific Underground crew, I am known to be the kind of dissenting voice about AAPI Month. But even
just kidding.
Even though I do have hesitations about it, I don't actually have hesitations around the reasons, the positive reasons why people have tried to implement this month. And even though I will say white America tends to want to focus in on the East Asian American experience. You know, when we're saying East Asian, we're talking about Chinese, Japanese, Korean people. There is something to be said for how Asian Americans themselves view the month. I think, you know, when it first came in the 90s, there was definitely just like this push of like, hey, let's just recognize API people in general. But the API people themselves were not just promoting East Asians. There was trying to like, hey, look at these East Asians. Aren't we great? But hey, look at these guys too. Let's talk about those people who are erased in those demographics when we don't, you know, separate the data and stuff like that. And so I think it's been an interesting kind of push and pull, where you have white America wanting to latch on to East Asians, and then East Asians using that platform and saying, like, we understand that we're a much larger group, and we understand that this is just a political movement. Like, you know, in our families, we don't go home and go, man, I'm going to eat Asian food tonight. Like, in our heads, we think, I'm going to go home and eat Japanese food or whatever it is. You think of your country, your ethnicity, however you want to define that. And so that's something that is difficult for me with AAPI Month. It's just like, oh man, we're all lumped together. It's a white supremacy term, really. At the same time, it's a term that we use to fight white supremacy. But I see how it can be an extremely beneficial thing if East Asian people are willing to expand the month and make it not about themselves and realize, like, wow, we just have this platform. And I think that's happening a lot more recently, especially with Islamophobia. I'm seeing a lot more discussion around this, like, hey, let's take this focus off of this and let's put it onto this, where the voices really need to be heard.
And There was a great line I heard from the poet Solmaz Sharif, who's Iranian American, talking about how with the director of the Asian American Writers Workshop, where she worked in New York, there's Ken Chen. They were talking about a widening of that definition because it's still, you know, part of Asia, and it's not really, you know, the idea can't change until, you know, people start doing it little by little. So
I have very neutral feelings about AA. Oh gosh, I can't even get the
AAPI Heritage Month.
Thank you. Because I just found out that about this month last year. And I feel like I don't quite have enough information to form an opinion yet.
But you're someone who grew up here.
The internet's out there.
Well, you're someone who grew up here in Oregon. You're kind of our local voice here on Pacific Underground. You know, so as someone who grew up, and we often talk about your really white experience in Salem and being one of the only Asian people. Did you know that you knew? And even though you didn't learn about it till recently, do you feel like you would have benefited as someone who didn't have a community, just like knowing that the month existed?
If I grew up knowing that May was
AAPI Heritage Month.
Thank you. I probably would have benefited a lot from it because I am Chinese American. So, and since a lot of Asian activism seems to focus so much on East Asians, I definitely have privilege there in that when we talk about Asian activism, then I'm part of one of the groups that people think about.
I think one of the things that is really hard for me about putting any energy, any of my own personal energy into celebrating this month is that if I do so, I need to go about like redefining the month for myself and how I talk about it to have more inclusive language, to mention other people from from different parts in terms of their ethnic lineage of the Asian continent. I think it's a really whack idea to try to elevate ourselves and then maybe go and elevate people who have darker skin from Indonesia, from the Philippines, from Southeast Asia, and from South Asia, and from Central Asia. I don't think that's how liberation is achieved. And I don't think that's how we fight racism. I think we all need to like lift ourselves together and have solidarity in the term Asian, and remember and name that Asia is a reference created by Westerners, and it's an otherization. It's a name that pegs all of us as non-Western, same as African American, kind of just like pigeonholes the richly diverse and varied cultures in Africa and just kind of whitewashes it. That's kind of like where I stand on that. I don't know how we go about kind of changing the dialogue about this, but I think we should stop using the word Asian just kind of like carelessly, and we should be more intentional about it and clarify it, especially to our white friends and loved ones.
So, Kanan, that sounds like a nice little segue to go into this interview that you did that I think is really interesting to include in AAPI Heritage Month show, because it's talking about more than just how we celebrate our heritage, but talking about the reality of what is being an AAPI person here in the United States. So do you want to give a quick little introduction and we'll move over to that?
Yeah, I did some organizing earlier, I guess like several months ago, and met a friend. Her name is Amina, and she is a daughter of Bengali immigrants. Her parents are from Bangladesh. And so I decided to talk to her about her experience of Islamophobia and how she feels about trying to fit under the umbrella of Asian Americanness. So we'll go to that interview now.
Are you ready to roll? It's like on a joypad, AABI, battle all fake and all wannabe. Press pause, you don't wanna start me. You can't class me in a category, I'm in a league on my own. Give me my crown and pass me my throne. Fate MCs, they need to be shown, they need to be told. I'm a liver go bad when I'm
leaving alone. In-between moments like for you? And has that changed in the past like 7 days or however long it's been since those executive orders have started rolling out? Have you been feeling like overall less at ease, secure?
For me, the last week has been mostly about like thinking about what my family is going through right now. So my parents are immigrants from Bangladesh, and they're pretty observant Shia Muslims and leaders within their community. So we lived here for like 2 decades, and they were pretty well known within the Muslim community and the Bengali community, and then they relocated to Manassas, Virginia a couple years ago. And like during that time, like I also left Islam and like cut it out on my own. I stopped wearing the hijab a couple years ago, but I wore it since I was like 8 until I was 22. And like grew up Muslim and then like a heavily Islamophobic time in the US. So for me, I guess the last week has been mostly like figuring out, like I have like the privilege of not wearing hijab, like not having one of those like immediate kind of markers. So like women in hijab is kind of the immediate marker, or maybe men with beards is like not even a thing anymore. Like it's not of a clear marker anymore, but certain forms of clothing that Muslims around the world wear, I guess it's tougher for men to be kind of like pointed out from a crowd, like, oh, that dude is Muslim. But women in hijab is like a pretty good marker. I don't know. All of these questions just make me think about like how weird Islamophobia is, like within the US context. Because it's not easy to tell who is Muslim and who's not. Like,
right.
It's a very basic concept, but like, you're not discriminating necessarily based off of race or national origin. It's almost like a mix of those things, like race, national origin, perceived religion, really.
Right.
And I think there's a lot of reasons for that. I think one, probably the biggest, is like Americans are really ignorant about Islam as a world religion. As like one of the biggest, fastest growing religions of the world. The second most practiced religion in the world, like literally billions of people practice. And so obviously it manifests very differently from context to context, like from country to country, within a country, within racial ethnic groups, different political groups. It looks so different. People practice it differently and believe Islam to mean different things. So like that in itself, like Islam in itself is like a behemoth, and so to like fit, you know, whatever like political agendas of Islamophobia, people have to like, Americans resort to some things, right? I think they think that Muslims are all Middle Eastern or equated with Middle Eastern, which is not true. Middle Easterns are a half of the world's Muslim population. There's more Chinese Muslims than there are Saudi Arabian Muslims, but like that's not a thing we know about in the US, and that like Muslims look a certain way or like all speak Arabic, etc., etc. So I think there are weird things about like how little Americans know about Islam and like how that influences how Islamophobia manifests, because often it's not even accurate, right? Like Islamophobia doesn't just affect Muslims, it affects people who are perceived as Muslims, which also includes a really large like South Asian population. I kind of was like caught in the middle of those two, because my family was Muslim. I wore hijab and kind of like fulfill some of those like religious criteria, but also my family, I think, is like pretty visibly South Asian. We look Bengali, and so we experience Islamophobia from all of those angles, like because we look brown and like my mom and I wore the hijab, and so I don't know.
What is that experience, say like walking with your parents alongside them, or thinking back to a couple of years ago when like right before when you stopped wearing the hijab?
My relationship with Islam is so different now than it was like a couple years ago, that like also my role advocating for my Muslim family and like my Muslim community has changed. I like find myself more like as a steward, or like I really see it as a privilege of like not wearing hijab and like with the racism that comes with that. And so I feel myself like I need to perform, like I need to act more on behalf of my family and like be more of an activist for them. But like I'm caught in a weird space where like I don't practice, but I did for most of my life, and like it was a very large part of my life, and like still is a part of my community and my family. But there's really no such thing as like a cultural Muslim, as there is like a cultural Jew that has kind of like ethnic or racial connotations. There really isn't the same thing with Muslims, because it's pretty explicitly a religion and way of life. So, but I find myself kind of in that camp where it's like, when I'm with my family, I'm kind of like, I don't know, I keep an eye out for them more, having experienced a lot of it, and like also now having the privilege of just being a woman of color and not necessarily a woman of color in hijab.
Mm-hmm.
So
I'm curious to hear about your experience, like being within that the pan-ethnic, really problematic umbrella of Asian Americanness, mm-hmm. and being someone who's not East Asian, which is mm-hmm. like the archetypical Asian American, mm-hmm. someone who is not agnostic or Christian or practicing some Eastern religion in mm-hmm. terms of like Buddhism, uh-huh. like Shintoism or Confucianism, like whatever yeah. stereotype people have of like
right.
Chinese religion. Like what is that experience like, trying to explain to people who are uneducated, which I assume is like almost everyone you run into mm-hmm. that's not of your community mm-hmm. or has some sort of affinity with your community, mm-hmm. like when you say you're Bengali, do you, like
what that means to people?
Yeah, do people what kind of questions people don't do people
know.
Ask?
People don't know what that means. People don't know where Bangladesh is like in the world, and so 99 out of those 100 instances I'll have to follow up being like, oh, it borders India. It used to be a part of India, Bangladesh and Pakistan were all the same country, and then over time like split. So that's I think how people are like, oh, you mean India, you know, and so like that's a way for people to understand, like to see me as Indian basically. But it is a really weird thing, and I think the experience of South Asians over the last 15-20 years has kind of like, particularly post 9/11, has been really weird for us, because we receive a lot of Islamophobia and kind of the racism that comes with that, because we're all seen to be Muslims, which we aren't. And we also don't really fit, like people see us as Middle Easterns and not as Asians, because people think Asians are just East Asians. And so we're in this weird like, are South Asians Asian? It like still feels weird like checking off the box Asian Pacific Islander on anything, because it seems clear to me like what they're wanting to know is East Asian. So I have a lot of friends who are Indian and Hindu Indian or Catholic Indian or Christian Indian or Christian Pakistani, and like they have experienced a lot of Islamophobia because of just how uneducated the American public is, but they also like don't see themselves as Asian. And I've never really been able to resolve those things, right? Like that is one of the real limitations of racial categories. Like, how are you gonna lump such a like diverse, huge continent together where we have like such different genealogies and histories? It doesn't work very well.
Yeah. How do you try to hedge against that sort of erasure? Mm. Do you have, even if it's maybe dispersed geographically, some like a community, a core community that you like gain a lot from checking in with? Or do you have like cultural artifacts that help you feel more in touch with that?
Mm-hmm. That has been a real question for me, like as a first-gen Bengali American citizen, like ethnically Bengali but U.S. citizen. Like, what does it mean to be a Bengali American? And like, I think all of us face those weird moments. Like, am I being authentic enough? Like, what does it mean to be authentic? Like, can I be authentic by not being Bengali? So those weird questions, and I think we settle them differently. And the truth is, like, whatever you choose to do is authentic. Like, we shouldn't kid ourselves to think that there is like an authentic Bengali-ness. But that being said, like, I think I found myself, like, after my family moving away and kind of losing contact with my Bengali community here in Portland for other kind of personal reasons, like, I do have this weird nostalgia and like watch Bollywood movies now because it's like a weird way for me to feel, it's like to validate like we have been here and we have industries and like we have institutions. Like Bollywood is the biggest movie industry in the world, and it's like, it's just nice to be like, yo, like we're not dumb and we can do things and we have beautiful stuff and like we have beautiful culture and like values and history. And so like for me it comes up as like watching Bollywood movies or like collecting like my mom's earrings or like earrings that come from Bangladesh and small little tokens like that, like wearing my nose ring. Recently I had to like fight back with my employer. There's like a no face jewelry rule at my office, and so I had to be like, well, no, actually, like that's because you guys took it from us. Like the nose ring is not a white hipster woman thing. It's a South Asian thing that was later appropriated by white people. To me, it means being a part of my family. Like my mom wore it and my grandma wore it, and it's been like a rite of passage for women in my family for generations. And like, I kind of had this visceral reaction where I was like, no, I can't actually take that off. So little things like that. And like trying to learn, like trying to keep talking, speaking in Bangla. Being around like other rad South Asians. I've been really fortunate to like run into a couple like rad queer South Asian people, femmes, over the last couple of weeks that I'm like trying to hang out with more. And that's and that's the first time that it's ever happened to me. Like for most of my life I've been pretty much like the one in my corner, being raised Muslim, South Asian, and there's just not that many. But I found a couple here in Portland and I'm stoked to bond over that.
Mm-hmm. Seems like the only acknowledgement that you really get of your existence, like going through, I guess, regular institutional channels in our educational system, mm-hmm. is Asian American Club, you know, mm-hmm. where that's immediately synonymous with being Chinese, mm-hmm. Taiwanese, mm-hmm. Japanese.
I never felt Korean. That support like in high school and college, like even now, up until recently I was like pretty, like everyone I knew in Apano here in Oregon was East Asian, Pacific Islander, and only like this week did I meet like South Asian activists like involved in Apano. Like I didn't even know like that was a thing. Like I didn't know we were allowed to be in Apano, so that was cool. I just like don't expect that kind of solidarity to exist.
That's interesting.
But yeah, it's weird. I mean, like we created that group, right? Like South Asianness. I think a lot of people use the word Desi to kind of refer to India, Nepal, Pakistan, Bangladesh.
Mm-hmm. Do you feel any connection with that word?
I do. But it's still weird. Like, the South Asian thing, I think, is weird because I think Desi has more of a, like, relation to, like, a Sanskrit word. And so it kind of refers to, like, our genealogies, like, the fact that our languages and peoples come from Sanskrit. But, like, South Asian, that just refers to, like, geographical location. And, like, we don't really talk about North Asian, which is Russia and, like, all the stands. And we don't necessarily call the East Asian countries East Asia. We call them Asia. So it's still weird. Like, it still doesn't really resolve anything. But definitely, like, have drifted more to, like, self-identifying as Desi or South Asian. Problem with, like, saying you're Desi in the U.S. is that nobody knows what Desi means. And so you end up having to explain it.
Oh, you mean Desi?
Yeah, no. So I try not to do that a lot, despite like that being what I prefer to think of myself as.
So circling back to that first question, like, does this climate, whatever that means to you, make you feel more ill at ease just in general?
I think I definitely feel more, I feel worse, less at ease. Because of our political state, which like kills my like anarchist inclinations. But it's true, and there is something very real about like what politicians in power do and what they get away with saying and how that emboldens people. Like we've seen a marked rise in hate crimes, and people like me have really felt a difference, and rightfully so and really so. Like I don't think we need to second guess that. Or think that it's in our heads. But I do feel way more like on edge, kind of like expecting white people to say something crazy to me and like being ready for those interactions, which is exhausting. Like I drive around my neighborhood and notice way more like which houses have American flags on them. And, like that's something I started doing a couple weeks ago. Not that people put up flags when Trump won, but that's like something I've caught myself doing. And like feeling way more anxious, definitely more anxious for people who are more easily targeted, like people in hijab, people in mosques, like people congregating together. Like I said, like I have that privilege of like not being super easily identifiable. I'm sort of racially ambiguous, like people don't really know that I grew up Muslim or that, you know, whatever, that like my parents are immigrants. But, like, after growing up, like, in Islamophobic U.S., like, that is my instinct, is, like, to be ready for all that.
All right, and you are listening to KBOO Portland right now. This is Pacific Underground, and we just heard an interview from Amina talking about her own experience with Islamophobia. And now we're going to shift gears kind of radically and maybe perhaps lighten the mood a little bit. We have some special guests, more special guests on the show today. We have Alex and Mazzy. Mazzy is an up-and-coming superstar. Has got some really mean cooking chops. She's 2 years old, and she is currently deeply engaged in an iPhone. She's with us in studio. And yeah, Jenna, do you want to get us started on this segment?
Sure. So the Mazzy Show is a YouTube cooking show, and we have a clip of it. So you, if you've never watched it before, you can hear Mazzy doing her magical cooking thing.
It's a Mazzy Show! Cooking Mazzy!
What are we making to eat today, Mazzy?
Cashew boat. Flour. Sugar. Milk, onion, cashew, ketchup, salsa, corn, starch.
4, 3, 2, 1.
Wow!
Oh, perfect. Okay, bring it over there.
Here we go.
Okay, thank you, Mazzy.
This is the final cashew bow. Cheers.
So that was a clip from the Mazzy Show. Welcome to KBOO, Alex and Mazzy.
Hello. Thanks for having us.
So I know we can't hear Mazzy, but Mazzy is sitting on Alex's lap. Alex is Mazzy's dad, and Alex is the producer, cameraman, director, editor of the Mazzy Show. And so you guys recently, if you guys had, like, you've been having this show since February is when you started the YouTube channel, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And just recently this week, your show kind of exploded on the internet. How did that happen?
Yeah, that was kind of crazy. It's been getting good response in general on Facebook. Like, a lot of people have been watching, and it seems like it was getting a lot of response from my friends and family and stuff like that. But then Angry Asian Man actually put out a little write-up on it and said that it was a cute YouTube show and that it was fighting kind of white videos that tried to white cooking videos of Asian food. And after that, I feel like it got a lot of response. And then Next Shark wrote something about it. And then I got contacted by, what is it, Mashable? So there was like a Mashable thing. And then now this did a video. And then just yesterday, Daily Mail put out something. So.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it's this last week that now this video, I mean, it just got like 500,000 views of us. And so, you know, I'm sure people are wondering, like, well, what does AAPI Heritage Month have to do with a YouTube cooking show? But I think it has everything to do, you know, with AAPI Heritage Month, in the sense that here we are seeing, you know, API representation, as you were just talking about. You know, it kind of decolonizes the white cooking videos that are so popular on the internet. Oh my God, kind of like, oh, the one that your partner, the one that your partner put out on the internet the other day. She may be aware of it. That was like
kimchi?
The 7-Up kimchi.
The white kimchi.
Yeah, but you put 7-Up, and I was like, dude, Mazzy needs to attack that one and show them like how it goes. And so I guess, like, as you know, as a parent who is putting this out there, you know, and is a part of this API heritage now and this media representation, I'm just sort of wondering, like, what's it kind of been like to be this focus right now, this media attention?
I didn't expect it. It's kind of a big surprise. I mean, even being on this radio show is really cool. And but it's been interesting, and it's been kind of jogging my thoughts a lot. I mean, definitely over the year, I've been thinking a lot about identity and what it means to be Asian American. And I didn't even think about those kinds of things a lot previously. I mean, mainly it was the elections and everything that was happening that really got me thinking. And actually, just spending time with Mazzy was an escape from that. But I realized that doing a cooking show as an Asian American is kind of a way for me to make art that actually talks about my identity. And originally, I was open to just cook anything that was easy, but there's been a really, really great response to Asian recipes. And they're all recipes that Anne and I cook on a regular basis. Like gyoza and mochi are definitely something that Anne cooks all the time. And I like to eat a lot.
Anne is Mazzy's Mazzy's mom.
Yeah, her artist name is Amisa. Yeah. And then myself, I grew up eating a lot of Chinese food, and the cha siu bao recipe is actually my mom's recipe. So to be able to do that, it feels really good. And my mom was like super stoked that I was doing it. And this is the one thing that I do creatively that my family and my mom really support. So it's made me really happy and proud to do that. But everything is really new, and I'm still processing the fact that there's actually a large response to what we're doing, or what I'm trying to do.
I can't even imagine what this is kind of like. It's all kind of just exploding literally this week. You know, but sorry, Tabitha, did you have something?
No.
Oh, I thought, didn't want to be interrupting there. But you know, when it comes to the Mazzy show, it's just, it is super cute, right? You can't get past the fact that, just like in the first 10 seconds, it's like, the Mazzy show. It's the most adorable thing to hear this two-year-old. But I will say that as an adult, you know, as an adult who grew up in a time where there wasn't a lot of representation, you know, and YouTube wasn't around and stuff, I have to say that I felt really moved in seeing how popular the Mazzy show is becoming. Because at first, just for disclosure, I know Alex in real life, that it was like, oh, how cute, Alex is putting out a cooking video. And then all of a sudden, I found myself sucked into something that maybe you and your partner hadn't maybe intended. I'm not sure. But I all of a sudden felt like, oh, look, there's the representation I wanted as a kid, and like how much this would mean to, like, I have a 4-year-old nephew right now. I'm like, I really hope he watches the Mazzy show. And like,
are you gonna try to make a cooking video with your nephew?
I've tried to get him to cook, and he's not quite as enthusiastic as Mazzy. He's like, okay, why don't you stir this? And he stirs it, and he's like, okay, now you stir it. I'm like, oh, well, look at Mazzy.
Oh man, some of it's a lot of video illusion. I mean, we take a lot of breaks because she has a short attention span, but she's been really enthusiastic about the steps.
Yeah, I just wanted to ask, getting back to kind of the, if you don't mind us talking about API Month and the representation and stuff, you know, I kind of wonder what you sort of feel about, like, the terms like model minority coming into this, you know, because you if you don't mind me, am I identifying you correctly, that you yourself are like Asian, identify as East Asian, you know? And so we definitely fall into that model minority place. Do you feel as though do you have thoughts around that when it comes to the Mazzy show and what you're representing? And do you even think about that kind of like message? I don't know, but that's all like really loaded.
Yeah, no, I've definitely thought about that a lot. I know that I've been, you know, it's like, why? Why are people paying attention to the fact that I'm cooking with my kid? It just seems like something that's more common. I think it's a pretty common thing. So I think for myself, I realize that people are looking for this type of content specifically right now. And there's something about it that's very political at this time, especially with race relations and how everything's going. And it seems like, I mean, I feel like Anne and I are in a very privileged situation. I mean, we're Asian American, but we went through the American education system, and I personally had really Asian parents. So it was like really strict academically, and I went to a four-year university and graduated, and we got married and had a kid, and we have a home with a kitchen that we can do this type of show in. So I feel like we do represent this concept of the model minority, which is kind of something that I'm not okay with. I mean, I feel like the idea of model minority makes it feel like people aren't struggling or something, mm-hmm. or that the struggle isn't real, and that I think the idea is that, like, no matter what, well, there's kind of an interesting thing. Anne is actually fourth generation Asian American, fourth generation Japanese American. So Mazzy's fifth generation American. So she's kind of descended from a really long legacy of American culture, but she's always going to be seen as foreign because she's Asian, and she's always going to be seen as exotic. So this is kind of something that I've been thinking about in terms of being a model minority. And I don't want everyone to have mainstream culture say, like, there's no problem with immigrants. Immigrants are doing really well in this country. Like, they can achieve anything that they want to. That's kind of the myth of the model minority. I mean, we're in a fortunate situation, but I don't necessarily see that as the truth, and I don't want to proliferate those ideas. So sometimes if people are pointing to the show as like, oh, Asian Americans, they can... They're, you know, there's no discrimination. Nothing's happening in this country that's wrong with racial relations. Look at these Asians. They're doing really well. I don't necessarily want to fall into that, and I don't want that to be the message of the Mazzy Show.
In your, you wrote kind of like a letter or an essay to us that we kind of used beforehand to get a sense of like what we wanted to talk about on this, with this time that we have. And in it, you kind of like are struggling with how the Mazzy Show kind of supports whiteness, and it also challenges whiteness and white supremacy. I was wondering, like, what ways you think it supports it, like, what, you know, like how, and like what more maybe could be done to really challenge whiteness and in a white viewership.
Yeah, like what I was saying, it kind of I feel like with the, I mean, the idea that people can point to it and be like, oh, immigrants are doing fine. Like, there's so much potential for immigrants here. Like, look at the Mazzy Show. They're doing really well. Despite the fact that we're very, very American and there's a long legacy that we've had to build here. But I feel like we have an opportunity here to really include voices of color into the programming, and also to highlight cultural recipes and things like that. So we really hope, and I'm even going to put this out there, we're looking to work, I mean, collaborate with people of color. Whoever wants to share a recipe with us, you guys can share a recipe with us on our Facebook or YouTube. Just send us a message. And also, if you want to be on the show and cook with Mazzy, just let us know. I mean, it's a weird film process. It's actually takes a long time to make. But if you're willing to put up with that, let us know. And we want to reach out to people of color to be able to have a outlet for that.
Whatever question I just had just like totally escaped my mind. Oh, I remember what I was going to say. If for our listeners, if you're hearing this bunching of a plastic bag, that's actually Mazzy eating.
She's so eating cornflakes right now. Yeah. And, like, what could be more American than that? It's like, I was thinking how you're saying how she's going to be exoticized for the rest of her life. Like, she's eating cornflakes and yoga right now.
I mean, it really actually kind of reminds me a bit of The Mazzy Show. One thing I like about The Mazzy Show is the recipes that you guys have chosen to do. You see a reflection of Mazzy's, you know, multicultural heritage that that she has, you know, in terms of, like, especially what is AAPI these days. So many people in America that identify as AAPI are not just of one heritage. They come from such a rich heritage. And so there you have Mazzy making chashu bao buns, but she's also making, you know, gyoza Japanese dumplings, but she's also making strawberry cupcakes. And then she's making, like, something that is considered more modern Asian food, like boba. And then she's making the Thai banana dessert with Maycat, you know. So she's really kind of representing a lot of what is the modern API experience. And, you know, and I think of what she's representing so much of what this generation is for her, of being more visible and having their own media that represents them, and that it can be more than just tokenizing of an Asian person and just being like, well, here's your dumplings. You can be here's your dumplings and here's your strawberry cupcakes and we're going to eat them all together, you know, sort of thing.
Well, we have, and I mean, Amisa and I have talked about that concept, that being fifth generation Asian American with a Chinese and Japanese background is a really interesting thing, because all three of those cultures, American culture, Chinese culture, Japanese culture, is all mixed up into that. And it's something that I feel like is a very modern concept right now.
It's a note. So does Mazzy like The Mazzy Show?
Oh,
like
she loves it. Yeah, she always asks to watch it. I was telling you guys earlier, she almost sees Mazzy as a character on television. So when she's watching the show, she's like, oh, Mazzy's mixing it, or Mazzy, Mazzy's playing with the cat. So she kind of talks in third person when she's watching The Mazzy Show.
That's so cute. As a parent, you must get just so much joy, like, watching her enjoy the cooking. Or, I mean, like, I guess that's a question. Does she enjoy the cooking? Because it looks like she enjoys it on the show.
Yeah. No, she's really enthusiastic about it. Whenever we're cooking on a regular basis, she always jumps on that little learning stand or whatever it is. Mm-hmm. She jumps on it and she's like, I want to do it. So I do think it's has a really positive impact on her just learning and doing things that are hands-on. So I'm really glad that we started doing it. I didn't know what what was going to result from it, but it seems like it's a really positive and healthy thing for Mazzy right now. I don't know about the attention. I'm a little weirded out by the attention, honestly, and I feel like maybe it's just, like, part of the news cycle, so it'll disappear and everything. But in general, I think that doing this activity with her is a really positive thing. And for me, because I'm a creative person, I need that creative outlet. Mm-hmm. So it just feels really good to be able to do a project like this.
You know, we're running out of time, which I'm totally bummed out, because I could just hang out and, like, talk about The Mazzy Show all day. It's super interesting. So, you know, if people want to watch The Mazzy Show, if they haven't watched it before, they want to, you know, contact you about being part of The Mazzy Show, how can people get more information?
Well, we're on a lot of social media. So we have a Facebook page that's kind of the hub of a lot of things. But we also have the YouTube channel that's just The Mazzy Show. And we have an Instagram. And I have other things, too, that people don't use as often, like Tumblr and Google Plus and stuff like that.
Is it all at The Mazzy Show?
Yes. At Mazzy Show is our Instagram and Twitter. And then we have, if you just Google The Mazzy Show, usually the Facebook pops up.
And that's spelled Mazzy.
Yes.
And, you know, we actually still have Jake here from the beginning of our show in studio. Jake, before we go, you know, Jake actually is an organizer of something here in Portland called the White Noise Project. Jake is a creative here in the city as well. Jake, do you have any stuff coming up?
Yes. Thanks, Jenna. We're hosting a poetry reading with several API poets at the end of the month, May 31st, with Neil Aitken and Pamela Santos and Jenna Fletcher at the Hilo Gallery on 34th and East Belmont.
Nice.
So I'll be going there.
More API representation. Excellent. That's right. In this AAPI month. Well, we hope that you guys have enjoyed our show this month. Hopefully it was a little less awkward than last year's AAPI Heritage Month. We hope we've given you something to think about.
Oh, thanks. But I like this one too.
Thanks, Jake. I appreciate it. Yeah. And so you've been listening to Pacific Underground. For Pacific Underground, I'm Jenny Yokoyama.
I'm Tabitha Tio.
And I'm Kanan Schlesinger.
And we're joined with
Jake Vermoss.
And
Alex and Mazzy.
Thanks you guys for tuning in. We'll catch you in 3 weeks.
We have this monthly film series at the Clinton Street Theater. We call it KABU at the Clinton. This month's film is Plant This Movie. It screens on Thursday, May 11th at 7 p.m. Plant This Movie explores the zeitgeist of urban farming from around the world, from Havana to Shanghai, from New Orleans to Portland, Oregon. The filmmaker will be present. Again, that's Plant This, Thursday, May 11th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
This is KBOO Portland. It's 9:59 a.m., coming up at 10, we've got Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary with your host, Chris Andre, followed at 10:15 by Flashpoints, generously shared with KABU from KPFA in Berkeley, California, through the auspices of the Pacifica Network. At 11, a Radio Geekly continues their series on gaming with a feature on card games. And thanks, KABU members, for all of your generous support. For those listeners who aren't currently active members of the KBOO Foundation, you may rectify that omission at kboo.fm. Click on the word donate. That's a handy little fiction we engage in with the IRS, but we know this is not charity. This is solidarity. This is right action. This is each acting for the benefit of all. And that's a beautiful thing. Be a part of it, won't you? All that's coming up because your friends and neighbors have made it possible. So stay tuned.